Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Hello, it's me here again, Martin, Electronically Yours, as always. Today's guest is someone that we've had kind of parallel careers in some respects. He's 4 years younger than me, but we have a lot in common, a lot of stuff coming from working class backgrounds and the kind of people that we liked when we were growing up and who were influencers for us. His name, of course, is Andy McCluskey from Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. We've known each other since back in the day, really, and always had a lot of admiration for his songwriting ability. Him and Paul, I've known them both kind of separately in some ways. We never really had a chance to hang out and talk very much together. We normally have a snatch 10 minutes here and there at various festivals and stuff. His career spans a huge amount of stuff. Loads of OMD albums, loads of, you know, things like Atomic Kitten. His songwriting is just great. Well, him and Paul. And he's a very engaging chap. He's very driven, and he had to be because, you know, came from a background with not very much, as we all did. So here he is, my good mate Andy McCluskey. I think there's a lot of parallels between your upbringing and my upbringing. I think there's a lot of parallels between Liverpool and Sheffield, actually. So tell us about your upbringing in Liverpool.
Yeah, we have a mutual friend in America, actually, who's been sending me little snippets of your forthcoming autobiography, which I have purchased. It's on the way to me soon.
Oh, I would have given you one. You didn't have to do that.
And I think, there's a lot of similarities. Very working class family. My dad was a Scottish communist.
Good lad.
My mother came from a middle-class family and definitely married beneath herself. She ended up as a hairdresser and a lollipop lady to try and make ends meet because my dad sadly was an addicted gambler. He was at the Greyhound 6 nights a week losing money. I grew up with very, very left sensibilities, but I don't think I was ever as politically active as you were. I think you were more active than. But,
How do you feel about what's happening now? I mean, do you still? What's your persuasion?
I have moved slightly more central. I'm still socialist, but I'm not as hard left as I probably was. The current state of affairs is, well, you know, we're recording this when we're about to get another prime minister.
If we wait around long enough, it'll be our turn, you know.
I would always vote Labour in a general election. I think that Starmer, when you read his words, makes sense, but he delivers them with all the charisma of roadkill. So it's hard to know.
He was MP for like, you know, 10 years. And I actually know him quite well. I don't trust him. Anyway, moving on.
All right, fair enough.
More cheerful. So you grew up in in the Wirral, right? And it's a very interesting part of the world, apparently. It sounds like it was a fishing port, was it, where you grew up? Where it used to be, anyway.
Well, it's kind of schizophrenic, really. Half of the Wirral faces the River Mersey and Liverpool, and half of it faces the River Dee and sort of leafy North Wales, and it's split down the middle by a motorway. I grew up on the north coast, facing out to the Irish Sea. Yeah, when I was a kid, there was a big concrete wall, but there were still fishing boats there. I used to go down there as a kid and, you know, get shrimps and come home, and you'd make yourself, you know, shell them all, and by the time you had no skin left on your fingers and you made just enough for half a butty, you know. But it was delicious. We're on the wrong side. I mean, people always talk to us about, Paul and I, that we were from Liverpool because it's the nearest major city. Yeah. But we were from a suburb. You know, we had to get the train to go in underneath the River Mersey. Paul actually was born in London. I mean, he moved to a little place called Mells, which is on the north coast of the Wirral Peninsula, when he was seven. And he came to my school. That's how we first met up with each other. But it was a nice place to grow up. Actually, it wasn't remotely kind of like an inner city or deprived. But yeah, we lived in a, because of the various issues with money, though, I did feel very embarrassed growing up because I felt like we were the poorest family in the town. Every single thing we owned was secondhand.
Is that because of your dad's gambling, do you think?
I don't think he lost an awful lot of his wage packets, but he would do lots of extra work to which he'd then go and lose. Every single thing we owned was secondhand. The carpet had been in several houses previously, and so the pattern was cut multiple different ways. I had an alcoholic grandmother who'd come round and wet herself on the sofa. Nice. You know, when the greyhounds weren't urinating and defecating on it as well. I earned my pocket money by walking the greyhounds 5 miles a day. That was how I got out of the house. Wow. But yeah, I always remember whenever I'd go round to a friend's house, I'd always just think, well, their house is nicer than mine. I don't want them to come to mine anymore. it was embarrassing.
Were you a smart kid at school?
Not especially. I was one of the kids who had to work their socks off to achieve anything. I went to a grammar school and I have no idea how I passed the 11 plus. In fact, I don't even remember taking it. I mean, nowadays it's such a big thing. You know, the kids get tutored. It's like an arms race. I mean, remember my kids did the 11 plus to go to the local grammar school. And we got them tutors and I looked at a paper and I was just like, I couldn't do it, you know. I was in my 40s, you know.
It's tough, that shit, honestly. But, yeah. Well, mind you, it's easier than doing the examination you need to take to become an approved immigrant into the UK. That shit is like, I couldn't. I'm not British.
you don't know enough of our history.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not interested.
Yeah, but I'm the one thing I'm glad that I did go to grammar school for, Martin, was because I had no work ethic when I was a kid. I just wanted to play and have fun and kick footballs around and do art and what have you. And one day I got so fed up of always getting like C's and D's for my homework. I thought, right, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to work really hard on this and I'm going to spend hours and hours and I'm going to write it out rough and then I'm going to copy it neat and I'm going to make it real. And I spent like 3 hours on a short English essay and I got my first ever A.
Wow.
And it was like a light bulb went on. It was like, oh, hang on, equation. If I work harder, I achieve more.
Yes,
you know, it was like that was my revelatory moment. Wow. And after that, I worked my socks off. And I think it's something I carried forward into the music industry, because one of the things you realize, and you must have been in bands when you were teenagers, everybody in when they're young, even when you're in professional bands, they talk a good talk. But when it comes down to actually getting off their asses and doing something, nobody wants to.
A lot of it is, I mean, I'm going through a little bit of this with my daughter at the moment. She's really talented and she writes songs and stuff. And I keep saying, just put the bloody things out to the general public, get some feedback, move on, adjust, move on. You know, be prolific, you know, is what I'm always saying. And I think it's a bit of an epidemic in the current, well, and maybe it's always been that way for young people, I don't know. But they, you know, they tend to want to avoid the judgment bit of it. And maybe it's a fragility thing, I'm not really sure. But anyway, you know, I think you have an amazing work ethic. I mean, the amount of stuff that you've done is incredible. The quality of it is incredible. And what... I'm jumping about the timeline here, but you know, when you did the Atomic Kitten thing, that I suppose was a kind of response to, my God, I better get on with, you know, I better get on with being successful here if it's not going to happen with OMD or that's finished. Was that how you felt at the time?
Yeah, I was conceited enough to think I could still write good songs. It was the vehicle that was perceived as past its sell-by date.
Right.
I mean, it's quite funny now, isn't it, to think back to the 90s when we still had this perception of linear culture, that, you know, this is new and that is old. Now we're in this kind of detonated postmodern era where every popular culture is consuming its own history, and everything is acceptable as long as it's considered sort of strong within its own genre. I mean, hallelujah, that's why we can still do festivals.
Exactly. That's why we're still here, isn't it?
But the Kittens was really just me being conceited and thinking I'll just get a new vehicle. I have to say, I don't know whether you know this. I mean, I have said this, but it is very funny because I always say to people that it was actually Kraftwerk that invented Atomic Kitten. People are like, yeah, go. No, I said, yeah, because I became quite friendly in the 90s with Karl Bartos from Kraftwerk, right, when he left, and we did some work together. And I was sort of bemoaning the fact that, you know, I'd worked really hard, and we had a song called Walking on the Milky Way, which only got to number 17 in the charts with its arms tied behind its back because Radio 1 wouldn't play it because they weren't their target demographic age, because Radio 1 wouldn't play it. Woolworths wouldn't stock it. And you remember the days when half the singles were sold in Woolworths on a Saturday, you know? It was like, so I just thought, I'm wasting my time. And I was whinging to Carl about this. And he said, well, you know, write songs for somebody else. But he said, don't, whatever you do, just be a publishing whore and write stuff and give them to people, because they'll come back to you and go, oh, can you change the words? Can you change the tempo? We don't like this, we don't like that. He said, why don't you create a vehicle for your own songs? So I said, well, like what? He said, well, what's the best manufactured bands? I said, three-piece girl bands. They always were, you know, the Supremes, the Ronettes, you know, and even Bananarama, you know. Although they weren't actually manufactured, they created themselves. And so Karl Bartos said, okay, Andy, create a three-piece girl band. So Kraftwerk invented Atomic Kitten.
Wow, that's amazing. I love that story. I've just been listening to a version that you recorded of that song. I have to say, I prefer your version.
I did it for a charity album. It was quite a challenge. Thank you. I was trying to sort of do an OMD electronic take on a song I'd written that was kind of sort of like gospel soul. But I'm really proud of that song, Hole Again. I think that.
It's a classic.
The first Kittens album was full of great tunes, actually. It was absolute fun. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. had no idea what was going on. The girls were bonkers, but amazing fun.
How did you pick the girls?
We put an advert in the Liverpool Echo, just saying that I was going to put a girl band together, and we got the girls through those adverts. And Although, Kerry came through a mate of mine who was a DJ in a band called the Pawn Kings. It was like a techno band in the 90s. And he said to me, he said, you're still trying to do that girl band? So he said, you've got to meet this girl in my band. She's going to be a star. She's wasting her time waving her tits around behind me, was his actual quote. And he showed me a video of Kerry on stage at some German rave. And I just went, yeah, I've got to meet her. And She walked in, and the first thing she does goes, do you want to see me new photos? And she gets out her topless photographs. I'm like, very interesting audition technique.
But it worked.
Well, you know what? She can't sing very well at all. I mean, if she wouldn't have been in the Kittens if there was no such thing as Antares autotune. But I knew she was going to be famous. She had that kind of like Marilyn Monroe kind of desperation, a beautiful woman who had to be famous to make up for the shit life that she'd previously had. And I just thought, right, you're in the band because you're going to be famous, and then we'll get some singers. So Tash and Lil, actually Heidi Range was in the band first. She was in the Sugar Babes. All amazing singers. So that's how it happened.
I always think there's so much talent out there, isn't there? They're just begging for an opportunity to show what they can do. Okay, going back to the start of your step, what always impressed me about, number one, I know obviously your key thing was electronic music and this template, which, you know, had as much in common with people like Suicide as it did us or whatever, you know, Kraftwerk. But at the core of it is just some great pop songwriting, which is evidenced by Atomic Kitten later and various other things that you've done. Do you think you could have, I mean, take the electronic stuff out of the equation, do you think traditionally you could have been like a songwriter, as in like the American theory of it, like in Nashville or something? Or I don't mean country and western, I mean, you know, like a kind of songwriter for other people on a kind of performative basis, right?
In Pan Alley Brill Building.
Yeah. Because no. I think you could.
Well, my problem is that I can't read or write music.
Me neither.
Nor am I a particularly gifted musician. I cannot jam. I don't know the chords and the notes. I have to think about them. So I can really only play my own songs, you know. I just don't know my way around.
Isn't that of benefit? If you don't know what the rules are, you're breaking them or not.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Stuart Kershaw, who plays drums for us now, who replaced Malcolm because Malcolm had his cardiac arrest, but is still fine and healthy. Stuart studied music and knows his way around. And he would often say, I really like the way, you know, what you've got that suspended seventh, but when then you get to the chords, you go into the major. And I'm like, really? I just put my hand on the keyboard and liked the sounds that came out, you know.
Yeah, but having an ear is the most important thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Paul and I learnt to write songs by playing music. You know, we just started making noises and writing songs. I mean, we were 16 when we wrote Electricity, you know.
That's amazing.
The first, he got a Vox Jaguar organ and a really cheap Selma Pianotron, the little plinky plink sound, and I had my upside down bass, and we wrote Electricity. It was the first proper song we ever really wrote together. Amazing.
Still one of the best as well, I think.
Thank you very much.
It's simplicity. It's like when people go on about being boiled, really. And the limitations of being boiled is what people like. And I go, well, we did two versions of it. We did a later version. And that's how it, if we'd have had the resources and the knowledge, that's how it would have sounded in the first place. But we didn't. And people still prefer the early version.
I have to say, I love that. I mean, I went out and bought that. And, you know, back in 78, you know, there was no internet. So the only way you knew about something was when it got either on the radio or it was in the music press. Because, you know, we would read every music paper, all of them.
That's right.
We'd read them to find out what was going on. And I have to say, actually, two things in the summer of 78 made Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark actually become a band. Because Paul and I had been writing together in his mum's back room for a couple of years, but we just thought it was a hobby. You know, our mates didn't like it. We did a sort of proggy rock band with guitars and drums, who did sort of rock band versions of our early songs. But we heard Being Boiled, and we were like, the fuck is that? Where have they come from? We didn't know about this. Somebody in Sheffield's been doing... And then, standing in Eric's club that summer, the DJ plays Warm Leatherette.
Yeah.
My widow said, what's that? I went back to Paul and said, right, we need to actually go and do a gig. We need to do our electric thing because other people are actually doing it. So your song was instrumental in us creating the band Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark.
That's very kind. Funnily enough, the same story came from Gary Newman when I interviewed him, you know, because they were literally booked into the studios to do a rock album. And then there happened to be a Moog lying about in the studio, and he started playing that, and he said, I'm going to do that. And then, of course, you came along, we came along, blah, blah, blah. And he went, nope, that's it, I'm cutting out all the... He still kept the drum and a little bit of rock stuff, but, I mean, basically the focus was on electronics. So we're looking... Right, the other thing that always impressed me so much about your ability to frame what you were doing was you've got these beautiful, simple pop songs, which are insanely catchy, but then it's overlaid with this real appreciation of cover art and a kind of love of the artistic context of what you were doing. And so explain to me why that was so important to you.
I started off primarily in visual arts. In fact, I was supposed to go to Leeds to do a fine art degree in September 78. And I took a gap year because I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to stick at it. You know, like a lot of teenagers, I changed my mind every few months about what I wanted to do. So I thought, I don't want to go to commit to 3 years and then not do it. And by the way, had I gone to Leeds in 1978, do you know who else was on that course? Greengartside, no. Dave Ball and Mark Armand.
Is that right?
Yeah, all at Leeds doing fine arts. That would have been quite a group, wouldn't it? Yeah. I think too many egos maybe. But yeah, so anyway, so I took a gap year. Paul and I started Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark to do one show.
All right, where did the name come from? Sorry.
Oh, we knocked on the door of the owner's office in Eric's and said, you know, hi, we played here on Thursday night, which is when they have their kind of local talent night, in our rock band incarnation. And we said, hi, it's Andy and Paul from The Id. Could we come and do a Thursday night with just two of us doing our electronic music? And we thought they'd tell us to get lost. So then, yeah, sure, what's your calls? And we went, oh, shit, we haven't got a name. So went back to the, went to my bedroom wall, where I used to write stuff down on the wall as my notebook, and a putative title for a song was going to be Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. Totally pretentious name, but then that's McCluskey
for love it.
Teenager,
love it.
Pretentious teenager. We kind of got lucky because right below Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, we could have been called Margaret Thatcher's Afterbirth.
Yes, probably not quite as good.
So we just decided to do that. But when we got offered to do Factory Records, a single on Factory, I wanted to do the sleeve because I had pretensions to be an artist and I had some ideas. And then I met Peter Saville, and I just went, okay, hands up, I'm not anywhere in his league. This guy's done a degree, this guy's great. And so we were blessed for the first like 6 years of our lives to have Peter Saville design all Amazing. Of our artwork, which, you know, I mean, the crazy thing was, after we'd done Electricity on Factory, and we signed to Dindisc, that was a subsidiary of Virgin. We walked into the Dindisc office, went upstairs, and there was Peter. And we were like, oh, what are you doing here? And he went, I've just become the artistic director at this label. What are you doing here? We've just signed. Oh, great.
That's handy, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, we were absolutely blessed to have Saville. And I think that Saville's kind of like the older brother I never had. I always looked up to him, always respected his thoughts. And we just got on because we can talk visuals. So it just was great to have him doing our sleeves.
Interesting. I mean, I'm...
There's a Dazzle Ships recreated by... behind me, you can see on the screen, created by a Canadian artist. And of course, Peter helped design the set that we did on the 1983 Dazzle Ships tour that looked like a kind of Russian constructivist ballet, which was brilliant.
Beautiful. It was beautiful. I remember it. I'm big mates and long-term collaborator with Malcolm Garrett, who went to college with Peter Saville. Mm-hmm. And they're all part of that, Ben Kelly and all that stuff. They're all part of the same.
Well, you know, actually, Malcolm bailed Peter out on the Dazzle Ship sleeve, actually, because for once in his life, Peter was ahead of the game, because Peter was infamous for delivering things late. He'd actually got a head start on the Dazzle Ships album because he said to me, can you write a song called Dazzle Ships? I went, why? He said, I've seen this great painting, a vorticist painting, Dazzle Ships in Liverpool Dry Dock. I want to do a vorticist sleeve. Write a song that I can put. So the tail wagging the dog. Brilliant.
That's brilliant.
I love that idea. So, isn't it beautiful when visual art can inspire music? I mean, I've always believed in that kind of...
It happens to me all the time. I mean, a lot of our stuff comes from visuals. But so, yeah, but Peter was working on the sleeve for so long, he had distilled it down to the point where it looked like a bad 12-inch. It was too simple. So right. At the last minute, he had to take it and all of his working out to Malcolm. And Malcolm kind of roughed it up and toughed it up again. It was actually Malcolm helped him deliver the final sleeve.
Is that right? They've always been good mates, actually. Yeah. He's a good man, Malcolm. Just going back to the throwaway comment, oh, visuals often inspire songs. So that you think that sounds quite like a normal comment, but actually I think it's quite abnormal. And I think as an artistic impulse, I'm fascinated. I'm going to write a book, hopefully, about what things I have learned from doing this podcast, talking to all these different artists and stuff. And one of them is this amazing kind of synesthetic kind of combination between different art forms and how it inspires music. And so I just want to dig a bit deeper into that, really. Give us an example of some more things that were inspired by visuals that you've written.
Again, right behind me, that's the original painting from our last album, The Punishment of Luxury, which I purloined the title from a painting in the Walker Art Gallery, which I've loved since a teenager, by an Italian. It's called the Punishment of Luxury. It was originally The Punishment of Lust, but the squeamish Victorians changed it to Luxury. It's actually, frankly, it's a misogynist painting. It's bad, in inverted commas, mothers floating in purgatory. It looks a rather beautiful purgatory, actually, the Italian Alps, but it's actually a misogynist painting, but I purloined the title to mean something else, and I've always loved that painting, so, because there was a band called Punishment of Lux.
There was, right?
You will remember, Punilux, yeah, who I think famously described themselves in the NME as their music being like an ark floating on a sea of shit. I remember that one.
Nicely put.
Yeah. So that's one. We have a song called Night Cafe, which is, I was, there's 8 Edward Hopper painting titles in the lyrics.
Really?
The new album is going to be called Bauhaus Staircase.
Yes, I read that.
After the Schlemmer painting. When Paul Humphries finishes mixing it,
Does Paul do the mixing then?
Yeah, he's more patient than me, got better ears, because I tend to write everything from the bass drum to the vocal. I want everything to be as loud as everything else. You know, yeah. I just keep pushing. It's like, get out the tin snips and just...
everything to 11 and 12.
Yeah, why won't this go past plus 6 dB? Paul is mixing. He has a studio, but the problem is he's moved 4 times in the last 2 years. So whilst I've been busy using COVID boredom to write an album, Paul's been... He also, you know... moved 4 times and made a baby as well, which kind of, he's been busy on several fronts. But so I'm waiting for Paul to do the mixing, and then hopefully it should be out next year, I hope. And but I mean, Triad Ballet is by Oscar Schlemmer, who did a painting called Bauhaus Staircase. And I'm reflecting on my love of art and how there's a line in the song that I realise I want to kick down fascist art, which I'm quite happy about.
It's got fascist in the lyrics. Yeah.
You would say that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would. I mean, your relationship with Paul is quite extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, not only have you known each other forever, but you've had fallouts, then you got back together. And how would you characterize your relationship? I know it's difficult. It's a broad question, but...
We are very different characters. So we bring different elements. I am very fortunate that Paul wanted to work with me, because Paul is actually, well, you know, Paul, he's quite lovely. He's quite passive in many ways, actually, which suited me because I'm a total control freak. So, you know, Paul will come up with great ideas. And if I've got an idea that goes with them, use them, he'll let me do whatever I want, you know. And when we sit together and write, I mean, you know, he will take direction. I'll go, I like that phrase, but sing, do that note next. So I was blessed to be able to make songs out of two people's ideas, not just my own. But Paul would generally just abdicate and go, yeah, okay, well, yeah, okay, you do what you think is right. You know, because I usually did the lyrics, I'd come up with the idea. And Paul would just go, yeah, okay, I trust you. Off you go. Take this melody, take this bridge, take this idea, take these chords and make something.
I think the key is trust, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, speaking from a Heaven 17 perspective, it's like me and Glenn and previously Ian, it's like we were like three heads on one body. I mean, we used to fill in each other's weaknesses and, you know, and there was no kind of pride involved in it. It was just a matter of getting the job done. Is how I viewed it.
But we did, you know, you are right. We have had our clashes, and I'm sure you've had them in bands previously. But sometimes, you know, you kind of, you just have to kind of step back and go, God, that person drives me insane, but I know I'm better with them than without them. You know?
Exactly. And so that's on a creative level. I mean, on a friendship level, I mean, when you're off duty, do you get on fine?
Yeah, we do, just as long as we're not watching football, because he's a Man United supporter and I'm a Liverpool fan, so it's not good.
Wow. Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he's, although he was born in London, his family is all Manchester, really. So he was the youngest by a long way. So his older brother was a mad Man United fan. So
I think, because I've got so many friends in Liverpool, I've kind of, Liverpool are my, because I'm a Wednesday fan, obviously, and, you know,
Having a decent season so far?
Yeah, we're doing all right, actually. Fingers crossed, we can do it this year. But anyway, we've been at a low point for a while now. But Liverpool, tell us about what's going on there. Liverpool are kind of like my adopted Premier League team, I suppose, because I like the style of playing. I like Klopp very much.
Yeah. I think everybody likes Klopp. I honestly don't know. I mean, I you know, we're all looking at each other going, was Sadio Mane really that good? or are they just exhausted? Did they come so close to doing four last year and they just can't raise their game anymore? I mean, Klopp demands that the team play at an intense work rate. Yeah. I mean, they are, and I think it burns players out. I mean, I also, you know, a lot of fans have been saying, you know, we love Klopp. We absolutely love Jurgen Klopp. But is this the reason why he never stays longer than 7 years?
Who does, though?
Well, I mean, yeah, to be honest.
7 years is a long, long time in today's world.
I mean, I am sure he will turn it around. But honestly, we don't know. I mean, is it that people have realised now that, you know, if they bang a long ball over the top of Trent when he's too far forward, we're in trouble? I don't know.
Everybody knows that now, don't they? That's the problem. He's a bit of a busted flush as a defender. I've still got, there's something not right in the midfield. It's just not clicking, is it?
The biggest problem I think we've got in the midfield is we have four midfielders who are invariably injured.
Right.
You know, Thiago and Henderson and Oxlade-Chamberlain and somebody else, I can't remember, that was off the top of my head. But it's like, and we've brought in two young kids, Elliot and Cavalier, who are good, but they're just too young.
This year.
You know, we need Fabinho holding.
Yeah.
But I just, I don't know. You're right. There's something not quite clicking in midfield.
It needs a kind of marquee centre midfield creative player. It could be a number 10 or something like Coutinho used to be. I don't know. Something's not right.
Another Gerrard would be great.
That would help. Yeah. By the way, I'm very, very good friends with Wendy, with the Oxlade Chamberlains, actually.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, they used to. Because Mark Chamberlain used to play for Wednesday back in the day.
Ah, okay, yeah, yeah.
And we used to hang out together. They're very good friends of ours. And I remember Alex came round with them one day to our house in Primrose Hill when he was like 7.
Oh.
And they said, oh, he's at the, you know, wherever it is, Portsmouth or Southampton Academy or whatever it was, and said, I think he's got a good chance of doing all right, this lad. He's such a great player. What a pity about all the injuries. It's
just, yeah, crazy. I mean, that's some, you know, just when he's starting to get his confidence back, he gets injured again.
Oh,
and that's it has been a real shame. He has shone for us occasionally.
Yeah. But not for long enough. So anyway, let's get back to music. Bowie, Kraftwerk, Roxy, Neu, Velvet Underground, Eno. These are all pretty much word for word the same influences as the early Human League and Heaven 17. Apart from, I mean, you understand and like soul music, of course, because that was part of, I suppose. But did you grow up with any soul influence at all?
No.
None?
No. My earliest references were my interesting combination, my mother's single collection, which was actually really good. She had lots of Beatles and Kinks.
Yeah.
And then Rodgers and Hammerstein's albums.
Oh, so, I love all that stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean, from the age of so from the age of 7, I used to be able to sing, you know, oh what a beautiful morning, oh, in a sort of weak baritone, and drive my sisters insane. But I loved the kind of slightly weirder side of glam, like Bowie and Roxy.
Yeah,
undeniably Slade were great songwriters. You know, didn't have much time for bands like The Sweet and things like that. But you know, that was because I'm just a bit younger than you, I think. So when, you know, when I was like 12, 13, that was it. Then I got into Steve Harley.
Right.
But then the first actual album I ever bought was Ziggy Stardust and Spiders from Mars.
Wow.
And that was, yeah, But interestingly as well, though, you see, I loved all of this alternative music, but the first single I ever bought was Without You by Harry Nilsson, which is just a heartbreaking, beautiful, emotional tearjerker. And I've always liked loads of emotion in songs emotional voices, but not really a soul fan. I mean, I didn't really get Marvin Gaye until about 10 years ago when somebody I was dating got me turned onto it. And I'm like, duh, why have I not gone to Marvin Gaye? But I had blinkers. I had real blinkers. There was things I was interested in, and everything that I wasn't interested in was just not on my radar at all.
Wow. That's interesting, isn't it? Because is that a good thing or a bad thing? Sometimes you can have too much, can't you? I mean, now we're in a world of Spotify, etc., where instantly you can listen to anything, you know. So I wonder if that's a big influence on your kind of focus on what you did. Interesting.
One of the most important things, I think, was people don't quite understand the Velvet Underground, but you know, they played traditional instruments in a non-conventional way, which I liked. But Brian Eno was my hero.
Me too.
I read something that Brian said. Listen, if you've got a load of secondhand junk shop equipment, you're the only person who's got that equipment, so that's your sound. And Paul and I looked around the room and went, this is our sound. This is it. The organ costs 25, the piano costs 20, my bass costs 37, and it's upside down because it's left-handed. That was the only one I could afford. Yeah, you know, this is our junk. This is our sound.
How amazing is that? Yeah. So limitations are a positive thing. Similarly, I've told this story a couple of times, but I saw an Eno article in NME saying all you need is a tape recorder, a microphone, and maybe a synthesizer, or build something yourself. I think it might have been the same article even. It was a dual-page spread, if I remember rightly. And that literally led directly to us taking ourselves a bit more seriously. Yeah, exactly. So you're a National Museums Liverpool trustee, is that right?
Yes, yeah.
And does that give you great pleasure?
Not when I have to read 180 pages of board papers before I actually have a meeting. But yeah, I mean, the Walker Art Gallery and what is now the World Museum were hugely inspirational to me. You know, when I was a kid, when I was in my mid-teens, I did a Sunday morning paper round, for which I got £1.67. That was the only thing I had other than my pocket money from my dad, which I'd kind of stopped walking the dogs by then. I would save my money for the whole next week, and either I would go to Liverpool and buy a German import record, or I would go to a gig at the stadium. The gig was 60p. The train was about 30p. I would have enough money to get something to eat and a sandwich and a drink, and I could go to the museums for free.
Nice.
I would spend the entire day in the museums, in the art gallery, then go and sit on the steps of the stadium, listen to all these stoned kids talking about Tolkien, which I didn't know anything about, but go and see bands at the stadium. And that was my Saturday, either £1.67 invested in a Kraftwerk or a Neu or a La Dusseldorf album, or going to gigs and going to the art gallery. So for me, it's just a chance to give something back, my time, to the places that were really, really inspirational to me.
Yeah, I agree. In Sheffield, it was the same. There's bugger all to do. But I was so keen on learning, and still am, that it was the Graves Art Gallery or the museums or, you know, that was it. There was not really much else to consume, actually. Apart from that, so yeah, we again another similarity between us. So you did a you collect art now, is that right?
Yes, I do.
And are you good at it, or is it just for pleasure?
Well, I stopped creating art myself. I have a couple of paintings hanging in the house that were by me, and I remember my son saying to me one day, he said, "Why are all your paintings 74, 75? And he stopped. I said, "June the 24th, 1975. Wow. It's a guitar with my birthday money." That was it. So although I was going to go to college to do art, it was mainly going to be kind of like found sculpture. And why did I pick Leeds? Because it had a studio.
Is that right? Yeah. So it's obviously in your blood, isn't it?
But yeah, so I've... following my father's gambling addiction, you know, collecting is an addiction. It is an addiction.
Yeah.
And I have this addiction. I have had to kind of like control it because I got carried away. I fell in love with the work of a potteries artist called Maurice Wade, who painted these very monochromatic, often quite... I mean, the first one I ever saw of him, I thought it was an abstract until I realized it was actually pillars reflected in a canal. And I just went crazy and started buying everything that I found by him. I loved it. And then a guy from Newcastle under Lyne, who has a gallery, Trent Art Gallery, Henry Burks from that gallery, said, "Would you like to do an exhibition?" Because he loves his work. So earlier this year, we did an exhibition of my collection. Yeah, so all 21 of my paintings came out of the house. The house looked nude. The walls were empty. It was really shocking. It was really amazing, Matt. It was like releasing an album because I did interviews, TV, radio, press. It was like releasing an album, but I was talking about somebody else's creativity, somebody who'd been dead for 40 years.
Yeah, but you know, people love... anything, people who are passionate about any particular subject, it's just engaging, isn't it? And the fact that, you know, you've got nothing ostensibly to gain from it, it's just that you love it, gives an insight into other people, into that work. So
I have definitely lost, actually, because the bloody exhibition and the book and everything and all that has now driven the prices up that I can't afford to buy his work anymore.
Yeah, but the things you own are worth more, so...
Yeah, there is
swings and roundabouts.
There is that. But it's... it's quite interesting, actually, getting...
So tell me... I'm very aware that we've... And before people who are listening to the podcast have a go at me. I when I do these kind of interviews with people who are very much in the public eye like you are, I try and avoid the obvious subjects like just going through your albums and all that stuff. I'm more interested in the stuff that creates the context for the creativity you've done. They can always go and research stuff online. But which of your albums do you think you're most proud of?
I think retrospectively, the Dazzle Ships album, because we were continuing to do what we wanted to do. I mean, you know, we became pop stars accidentally. We didn't know that we were going to have hits. We didn't create a band called Bloody Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark because we thought it was going to sell lots of records. Not with a name like that.
BOND is a nice acronym, isn't it?
So, but it abbreviates well. So, you know, we were just doing what the hell we wanted to do. And the fourth album, Dazzle Ships, was very much in that vein, you know. And in fact, actually, one thing was, it was a bit of a swing. We'd done Architecture and Morality, which was hugely successful. And the record company said the wrong thing to us. They said, another Architecture and Morality and you'll be the next Genesis. Ooh,
wrong thing to say.
Ouch. So I went, right, we're not sounding like that. We're going to do something totally different. And off I went with my shortwave radio and all my communists. Because I used to love listening to shortwave radio as a kid.
Me too.
Listening to all the stations with their call signs.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Radio Tirana. And whatever it was. So we did that It nearly killed off Korea commercially at the time, but subsequently it seems to be name-checked by so many people as being, you know, the album that was just too far ahead of its time, but now it makes sense. And you know, how crazy is it that, you know, a few years ago we got to play the whole album at the Royal Albert Hall?
I remember it, yeah. I didn't go, but I remember.
I would, you know, if you have to make me pick one, I'd probably say Dazzle Ships.
Fantastic. So, the other thing I love about you guys is that you've maintained your kind of artistic, not, I don't mean visually artistic, I mean artistic credibility throughout all the ups and downs and the splits and the getting back together, and then you write some commercial sounding songs and then you do it, but you know, the continuous thread that runs through it all is this kind of rock solid love of the craft and the art, and I think that's a rare thing today. Do you agree with that?
It's nice of you to say it. I'll be honest with you, there have been a couple of times when we lost that mentality and ethos. I think that in the mid to late 80s, you know, we started to realize that we were professional musicians and we needed to sell records to stay alive. Yeah. And of course, we signed a deal that was barely legal. I mean, some royalties we were getting. Well,
We're still under an in perpetuity publishing deal as well with Virgin.
Yeah, no, I was recently asked if they could utilise the video and music for one of our songs, Joan of Arc, in a documentary about Branson, and I categorically refused.
No thanks.
We had, for all the millions of records we sold, we were running out of money because we were trying to break America and America was breaking us. We did an amazing tour with Depeche in 1988, where, you know, they were earning enough to retire, and we were losing about $5,000 a day supporting them.
Wow.
And but you see, Depeche had a 50-50 deal on music. You know, so for all, once they paid off the costs, the profits were 50-50, whereas, you know, we were on like 11%. All the costs came out of it, the videos, the recording, the advances, that, you know.
It's obscene.
Yeah, so I mean, it wasn't about the money, and I'm sure you'd say so. About the money, but you cannot run a band if you're not making a profit. So we got to 1988 at the end of this with Depeche Mode, having sold millions of records, and we owed Virgin £1 million.
Holy shit!
Yeah, we were in debt. We were unrecouped by £1 million.
We got to about $500,000, I think. And we finally recouped in the early 2000s, I think.
Wow. Yeah, well, And it wasn't, well, I'm sure you were like us, it wasn't because you were buying your own Learjet or yacht or living in a castle. It was just, that was how, you know, they took, they gave with one hand and they took back with £5, you know?
That's right. That's so right. It was really a bad thing. It's a bit like, I liken it to third world debt. It's the way that they operate the world.
But because of this debt, we were being pushed into, you know, we'd come back from tour and our manager would go, you know, you're skint, you need a new album now, because he wanted 20% of the advance as well, you know. And it was just, you know, so there were a couple of albums in the mid-80s where, you know, had we had more time, we would have had a better quality of songs. And also we started to use producer Stephen Haig, who was a good producer, but didn't work for us because he made us more, we thought, more middle of the road.
Right.
But the reason why, because we always produced ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And just had a really good engineer. But once we started to lose a bit of confidence, then you start to go, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't sound like this. Maybe we should do that. Maybe we need somebody else to help us produce the record, because we just lost our confidence.
And it's a similar story with us. You know, we started using more session players. We went down that road. We were very aware that we wanted to please the record company and have hits as well. And we just lost our vibe, you know, and it's very similar time as well.
But that was the thing. When we got back together again in 2006, the first thing Paul and I said was, we are going to, if, you know, first of all, it was just to play the old stuff. But then very quickly we were like, well, are we now just a tribute band to ourselves? Let's not do this. Do we dare to write new music? We said, if we're going to write new music, first of all, it's got to be good. You know, we're not going to do crap that's like a pastiche of ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And secondly, we're going to do what the hell we feel like doing, just like the old days. We're going to go back to our rule book, which is basically there are no rules.
Yeah.
And just do what we want. And that's what we've been doing.
I think that's an admirable thing. Well, I mean, yeah. I can relate completely to that. Well, we're coming close to the end of it. It's just
very soon. I have to go and lock myself in a windowless room with three overweight middle-aged men and make a lot of noise.
Oh, really?
we're rehearsing in half an hour. Yeah.
Are you? Oh, sorry, mate. Okay, we just got the smash hits questions to do.
Oh, go on then.
Okay. So, what's your favourite film?
Oh, not at all cool, but I love it to death. Like, easy listening. The Quiet Man, starring John Wayne, Maureen O'Hara. He's an American, goes back to where he was born in Ireland and tries to buy a cottage. And it's all of the John Ford Western movie cast pretending to be Irish. I love it. It's great.
Oh, wow. That's
Quiet Man. If you want total escapism, and it's the most charming, lovely film you'll ever see that still has the IRA in it.
Okay. TV series or past, present?
Oh, Time Team. Absolutely Time addicted Team. To Time Team, yeah. Love Time Team. I wanted to be an archaeologist when I was young. But
then, did you?
Yeah. So I love Time Team. Yeah.
Time Team. I like that instant response. Book.
Most recent, Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari.
Yeah, it's very good. I've read that.
Brilliant book, yeah.
I'm a big...
I don't read fiction.
I think I'd have been an anthropologist if I'd ever gone to university.
Well, I'll tell you what, though. I mean, I'm looking forward to your book, and it's coming just at the right time because I'm just about to finish Karl Bartos's book, which is...
Oh, right.
You read Karl's book?
I haven't. I must get it.
Recommend it.
Is it on... do you know if it's on Audible?
No, and no, I'm a big Audible fan as well.
Yeah, me too. It's,
have you done yours on Audible?
Yeah.
God, why am I buying the hardback edition? Must have taken weeks of your life.
Oh my God. Have you ever read your own?
No, but I love Audible books, but
don't do it.
You're never doing it again though.
It's a fucking nightmare. It took me three and a half solid days, 8 hours solid of reading. I mean, worth it in the end.
Okay.
But you know what? You have to become kind of an actor, and I'm not really... I think my voice is well modulated, and it's not boring to listen to, but it's just super hard work. Anyway.
Oh, I'm going to get the audio version now.
No, the audio version is funny,
though. You'll have two sales now.
By the way, this is funny. You'll like this. There are various things where in the book it mentions people I've worked with, and in the book it mentions some lyrics that are sung in your head. And of course in the audiobook I go, oh fucking, I can liven this up, and I'll just sing, you know, like I was working with John Lydon, for instance, and I was singing like him, and they said, the publishers came back and said, you know those bits you've done where you're singing, not just John Lydon and everyone else, if we do that, we're going to get permission from the publishers and they might want some money. I'm kind of ridiculous. So what do we do then? So I had to speak to them in a musical manner. Oh, it's fucking stupid. Anyway, epiphanal moment. I think you mentioned it earlier. An epiphanal moment in your life, a moment of realisation.
A moment of realisation.
Or a big kind of handbrake turn or a light bulb. Or...
Well, I tell you the moment that... There is one moment that changed my life, and I wasn't actually there at the time. Okay? And we had heard this story, and we thought it was some apocryphal thing.
Yeah.
We had played Factory. Eric's club liked us what we did, and they said, we've got a reciprocal arrangement with this club in Manchester called Factory. We went down there. We met Tony Wilson off the telly. It was his club night. And so we cheekily, after playing there, we saw the Human League Granada Reports. Yeah. And we thought, oh, bugger it, we just met him last week. Let's send him a tape and see if we can get on.
And you did?
No. What happened was his wife gets into the car and there's a shopping bag full of cassettes. And she goes, oh, what's this, love? And he said, oh, it's all the stuff for the new label or for the TV show that's rejected. I'm taking it to the tip. She put a hand in the bag, pulled out a cassette, and she said, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. That's a weird name. Oh, they played the club the other week. Didn't really like it. Too heavy. Electric nonsense. She put it on. It was Electricity. She went, that's a hit. And she badgered him until he went, all right, love. Patronizingly tapped her on the thigh and went, I'll sign them just for you. That is the moment that changed my life.
Oh, God.
We were pulled out of the bag on the way to the tip by Tony Wilson's wife.
Is that right?
That is a true story. We met Lindsay Reed a few years ago, and she said, yes, it's true.
That's quite impressive, I have to say.
That's how you get a record deal.
Oh, wow. Okay, visual artists. I mean, obviously, this relates greatly to you. I always ask this question. Some people go, I don't really like visual art. So I know you like Maurice Wade or whatever his name is. But, any visual or conceptual artists that you would like to
get
people off about?
When I was a young teen, I liked J.M.W. Turner. Loved Turner.
Yeah, beautiful.
His later work where he's just painting atmosphere, the paint application with the rain and the clouds, and I love that. Then I got really into kind of conceptual art. I was really into abstract expressionists for a while, but if I see a Pollock now, I just go, doesn't talk to me at all.
Yeah.
I've got a soft spot for various Picasso eras, and Warhol.
There's a lot I like. Have you? Presumably you've been to Peggy Guggenheim's museum in Venice and seen the works that are in there.
I've never been to Venice in my life.
Oh, you're joking.
Well, you know what? I'm in the process. Whilst Paul mixes the album, I am doing a tour without a microphone under my nose. So I'm going places I want to go where I don't have to sing.
Listen, when you go to Venice, because I used to live there for 30 years, I had a flat there. Let me know, because I've got loads of tips for you. And you never know, I might even be in town at the same time that you are.
All right, I will do Martin's Trip Advisor for
you. Yeah, please do yourself a favour, because I've put a lot of research into that. Right, hold on. So, favourite other artist?
If I pick one? All right. Do you know what it's going to be? Because I've checked my iPlayer and which artists... albums I listen to more than anybody else's, Roxy Music.
Right. A fair choice, I think. It changed my life. It completely transformed my life when they came out.
Yeah.
Which is your favourite Roxy Music album?
For your pleasure.
Right. I like the first one best. Although it's not the best sounding.
Listen. The Bogus Man. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. I remember seeing him perform. Did you see them back in the day when they were performing?
I didn't. No, you see, because I was 12 when Virginia Plain came out. You were like, what, 15 or something?
Yeah, I was 4 years older than you. I was lucky enough to see them performing that at the City Hall. Oh. And it was fucking amazing. In fact, I saw Roxy Music 3 times before Eno left.
Oh, my word, you lucky man.
Yeah, I know. I looked out. Definitely. Anyway, in fact, the week of the release of the first album, I saw them performing in Sheffield. Right, so what else have we got here? Do you like classical music?
I do.
And who's your favourite classical composer?
Ralph Vaughan Williams.
Beautiful. Much underrated, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And a song that you wish you'd written...
Heroes by David Bowie.
Yeah, and that's another thing. Robert Fripp never gets the credit he's due for that. I think
I insulted Toya and her husband, actually. But I did a TV show with her. I said, your husband's made a career out of playing one note. He's a genius.
I don't think you thought you were insulted. I think that's... Oh, no, come on, that's unfair.
You know what I mean? I know
you were teasing.
Wailing kind of just... But, yeah, I mean, it's got that amazing combination of that, you know, it's got that rolling bass, like...
Yeah.
But it's just got that drone that's going on all the way through. Yeah. It's just the tension, and then Bowie lifts up the octave. And I read a thing with Tony Visconti who said, suddenly... We had mics at the other end of the room and the gate opened up when he got louder, when he went up there. And that's why his voice suddenly sounds completely different, because the mics are at the other end of the room giving him this really weird sound
that's
when he goes up the octave. Yeah. So
if you were going to do a Bowie cover, you'd probably do that, would you? I think you'd be good at that.
We've actually done a couple of Bowie covers.
Have you? Which
Radio
one?
Radio 1 sessions. We did Heroes and we did... Oh God, what was the other one?
I can hear you singing that.
Yeah. I mean, listening to that that Heroes album, I remember I was 17. My friend John had a flat in Birkenhead. And my Julia Neal, who wrote Julia's song lyrics. We would go to his flat. We had no money. We had no electricity. He had hot wired his record player into the light bulb through the flat below, so as long as they had their light on, we could listen to them. We huddled under our coats in the middle of the room, listening to that album, Heroes album, particularly the second side, when you can see your breath. It's just, you know, we were living that Cold War Berlin experience.
That's a great story. I remember a mate of mine he did the same thing. He hot wired into the gas supply from the next flat. That's quite tricky, that one.
Yeah.
Anyway, so final question. What's your favourite synth?
All right, I'm going to offend the purists now. Your favourite synth, let's be honest, your favourite synth is the newest one, because you've just got a whole new palette. You're really excited, right? I'm all digital now. I upgraded my Pro Tools. I got a whole new bunch of toys. So I'm a huge fan of the Buckler Easel 5 by Arturia and the SEM V2 by Arturia, because they've got bonkers sounds. But you know what? The simplest one, the Vacuum by Air.
I don't know it.
It's so simple. It's two oscillators and it's a soft synth. And all the purists are like, surely it's a Jupiter 8. Surely it's a... It's like, I am completely dedicated to soft synths and I love... Vacuum. It's kind of a bit like an SH1, but
right.
It's just dead simple. It's just, you know, it's, I love it. Yeah. So that's the sound of the last three OMD albums of that Vacuum.
Wow.
Same setting, slightly pitched, spread out wide left and right.
Yeah. I love it. It's been a joy, Andy. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
It's been great. Do you know what? It's so nice to be able to talk to you for an hour instead of the 3 minutes we normally get backstage when we bump into each other.
Do you know, the thing is about the podcast is that I've reconnected with so many, or connected properly for the first time with so many people. I feel like that's been the real benefit of it all for me. I mean, quite selfishly, you know, not just because it gets so many thousand listeners or whatever, I'm not bothered, but the just having significant conversations with people you respect and admire is really what it's down for me. So thank you.
Well, it's been a delight, and you know, thank you for
And I'll see you at the next, whatever it is.
Whenever it is. Well, now I'll see you in Venice, darling.
Oh, yeah. No, seriously. When you're going, give me a shout and I'll send you a bunch of recommendations. Super. And if I can get over there at the same time, I might even show you around for a few hours.
All right. Well, listen.
All right, man.
Take care. See you soon.
See you later.
Bye.
Andy, lots of interesting stuff came out of that. As I mentioned before, our backgrounds have a lot in common. And, you know, discussing the ups and downs of our careers and periods when you can't get arrested. But this is a common thing for a lot of artists. As I mentioned before, you know, Tina didn't have a record contract when I started working with her. Neither did James Brown at the time that I was meant to be recording what I recorded Tina with. We also a great common theme is also our love of visual art, even though we never went to art college like Andy did. It's always been a big deal for us to represent ourselves or have control of how we're represented visually and conceptually, in a way just as important as the music. And, you know, he always delivers. That's the thing. He's a man of great energy. I mean, I've seen him perform. We did a tour called Night of the Proms with a big orchestra in Germany, and he's done several of those tours. His stagecraft is pretty energetic and out there, and you've got to admire that. And he knows his stuff. You know, he loves his synthesizers, he loves his... he's a bit self-effacing about his production capabilities. He says that Paul does a lot of that stuff, but I suspect he knows exactly what he's doing. Another common theme from a lot of our previous podcasts, was never trained, per se, music. Doesn't read or write music. Just goes to show, doesn't it? Anyway, how's everybody coping? We're entering into kind of proper autumn with storms and getting darker and the clocks go forward. I may have already gone forward by the time this comes out. So darker evenings, it's more like hunkering down for winter, isn't it? Lots of exciting stuff happening there, lots of interesting guests coming up. Don't forget to email me, electronicallymartin with a Y at gmail.com if you have any comments. And also, if you want to, please consider supporting the podcast. I don't have a sponsor at the moment, so I'm losing money on every episode. I really don't want to have to knock it in the head because I can't afford to do it anymore. So please consider supporting in a small way on patreon.com/electronicallyhours. Really appreciate it. It's pretty cheap and it'll make you feel warm and glowing inside, I'm sure. That's it for this week. Another great guest next week. Bye. Martin Anders. First of all, thank you for making my everyday drive to work so much more interesting by providing all these fascinating and entertaining conversations in your podcast. Please allow me to suggest Robert Gurl from DAF as a future guest. That's a good idea. I shall put that on the list. Thank you. Cheers from Hamburg, Martin. Heather Propes. I'm really enjoying the podcast. I like the interview with Fatboy Slim. It caused me to seek out David Byrne's Here Lies Love album, and I've been singing along ever since, in the car only. I also really enjoyed the interview with Richard Barbieri. I'm a huge Japan fan, and my favourite was Adolescent Sex. It's too bad David Sylvian wants nothing to do with those days, but it's his prerogative, I suggest.
Heaven 17 was the greatest. Well, it's not a past tense, is it? We're still there. Loved you guys in 85. Still love the music and the art. The videos are what draw me in, especially Let Me Go. You often talk about Sheffield, which must be imprinted on your consciousness based on how you describe it with factories and loud noises, like Detroit was probably. I was around in Detroit 2007. It was very surreal in an abandoned sort of way. It's still like that. I visited Detroit for the first time about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I found it really disturbing. It was like being in a futuristic dystopian movie. Anyway, your music captured that dark industrial quality, but you balanced it with the glossy consumer pop feeling and soulfulness. Thank you. Cetra talks about the cabs, which is really good. So many different aspects to electronic music. You seem to be capturing many of them, and I will continue to enjoy the show. Thank you, Martin. Thanks, Heather Probst, Jersey City, NJ. Elliot Douche. Hi, Martin. Hope you're well. I'm gradually catching up on the podcast episodes. My recent favourite guests so far have been Youth and Professor Brian Cox. Some suggestions for guests. Chris Corner, Tom Rowlands, Chemical Brothers, Gerald Simpson, Guy Called Gerald, Robert Denaja, Massive Attack, Liam Howlett, Prodigy, Bernard Sumner. All great ideas. This is from Stevie Beer. Stevie Bear. Beer. Still loving the podcast. Keep up the good work. Getting to know these people, even if vicariously, through the podcast. Interesting chat with Polly Scattergood, who I've liked for a while. In particular, about women in the business, it got me thinking about some really great female artists you could speak with. Probably varying degrees of difficulty here, but worth considering, maybe. Here goes. Ostra, Katie Stelmanis, Tori Amos, Zola Jesus, Yonah Lee, Let's Eat Grandma, Georgia, Christine and the Queens, Lauren Mabry of Churches, Grimes, Fever Ray, The Knife. I think we're on the trail of Fever Ray. In general, here are a few further suggestions. Trent Moller, Paul Buchanan from Blue Nile, Arnone, Boards of Canada, I'd love to get them. Brian Eno, I've been chasing him for the last year. Billy Curry, done that. Thanks, Stevie.